It is an honor to welcome Camille Stallings today here for this seminar. I would also would like to thank all the colleagues online present at this moment. So I'm going to introduce Camille. So Camille Stallings is a DPhil candidate at the University of Oxford. Her PhD thesis is titled The Ethics of Friendship in the Victorian Novel. Her research also focuses on the periodical press, associational history, and transcultural friendship in the long 19th century. She writes the Economics Review chapter every year for the year's work in critical and cultural theory published by Oxford University Press. She has contributed 5 entries to the Palgrave Encyclopedia of Victorian Women's Writing and is currently writing a chapter on coverture and the sensationalist novelist Annie Thomas for the Women, Money and Markets edited collection. 3 MAs, so that's quite impressive, include English and American Literature, Eastern Classics and Liberal Arts. And today she's going to present a paper entitled Toxic Friendship and the Snobs of England, Thackeray, the Periodical Press and Social Critique. So the floor is yours, Penny.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's absolutely wonderful to get to see your beautiful campus and such a treat to wake up to the snow, something I do not get to see in Oxford. So thank you for having me here. I also just wanted to say that this talk today is the beginning of a much bigger project, and it's at its beginning stages. So I would love questions and even suggestions. So if something pops up in your mind that you'd even like to suggest to me, I would be very open to that. So before I get into the talk I had prepared today, I thought I would set the scene a little bit. So I will be focusing a lot on Clubland. Clubland in England, or in London specifically, it's an idea as much as it is a place. And the idea is that it is a very exclusive space. In the 19th century, it was also not just exclusive in terms of social rank, but also gender. So women were not allowed to be members, and for the majority of the century, they were not actually allowed legally to even have their own clubs. So this was a very exclusive space. I also wanted to give you some of the historical origins, just so we can fill out just how exclusive this space is. So back in the 16th and 17th centuries, sociality or social life was often held in public coffee houses. These were not exclusive spaces. They were very open. And all the classes intermingled and would have coffee together and discuss. People would come after their European travels and want to share their stories, etc. But what became very interesting about these spaces is that it didn't take very long before the higher ranks of society, while they stayed in these coffee houses, they would go to exclusive rooms within the coffee houses. So very early on in this sociality, the scene of sociality, there was demarcations, there was differentiations made between ranks. Eventually, this is how we get Clubland. Eventually, the aristocracy and the wealthy merchants stopped visiting the public houses, and they built their own palatial clubs on Pall Mall. Pall Mall is a street in London, and it's an easy view of Buckingham. So there's this architectural and geographical link between friendship in these clubs and Parliament, between running the country and the empire and who you have coffee with, who you dine with in the evenings. So that is Clubland. And it's really important to think that Clubland is both an idea and a real place. And you can go today and walk down Pall Mall and see all these palatial clubs and try to peek into their windows, but they're so high, it's actually very hard to sneak in. Okay, so that's the background with that. And so exclusive were they that even Charles Dickens refused to let his son become a member of one of his clubs. He literally blocked him from membership. So this is a competitive space. The other thing I wanted to set the context with is a bit of the historical context. And the time period we'll be talking about is very close to the reform, the first reform bill. And so I'm just going to give a quote from Gordon Ray. I don't know if anyone has ever read Gordon Ray, but he is prominent for anyone who reads Thackeray or studies Thackeray. And so this is a bit of a long quote, but I thought it would be really helpful. And this is Gordon Ray's commentary on the Snobs series in Punch. Okay, so I'm quoting Gordon Ray now. "Moreover, by the middle 1840s, the deferential principle no longer claimed the unquestioning acceptance that it enjoyed even a quarter of a century earlier." So again, this is after the Reform Bill, when there's more of a demand for political representation and involvement outside the aristocracy. Okay, returning to Gordon Ray. "The social norms of being deferential still held, but they had been seriously shaken, and the result was a prevailing malaise in social relations, a tendency on the part of those in the superior classes to insist too much on their accustomed privileges, because they could not always be sure that their claim to those privileges would be recognized, and a corresponding tendency to resentment and rebellion among those in the inferior classes. Hence, the omnipresence of snobbery." So snobbery at this point, even, which is something we can talk about in the question and answer period, Thackeray actually redefines the word snob. Okay, returning to Gordon Ray. "So hence, the omnipresence of snobbery, of an uneasy, because insecurely grounded, pride in position, was perhaps the most striking feature of this period of English social life." Okay, so I hope that that really contextualizes and grounds the talk that I will now go into. So just think reform bill. There's more of a serious who gets to run the country and the empire is at stake. It's being threatened, or there's a perception of it being threatened. And then clubland. And you'll see why I emphasize clubland. Okay, so now I'm going to jump in. Okay, on the 12th of June, 1858, a young journalist named Edmund Yates published a pen and ink sketch of Thackeray in a lowbrow publication called Town Talk. This paper, launched by John Maxwell, profited from gossip gathered in elite male spaces, like the gentlemen's clubs that lined Pall Mall in London and sat in easy view of Buckingham Palace. Town Talk sought neither credibility nor prestige. Instead, it wanted to be both, quote, offensive and notorious. Edmund Yates, an aspiring writer and a young friend of Charles Dickens, was appointed sub-editor. Although essentially obscure, Yates was known among London's journalists and literary men for his anonymized column, The Lounger in the Clubs, published in the Illustrated Times, notably a competitor of the London Illustrated News. Just like his Town Talk writing, Yates' Lounger column peddled insider news about members of Parliament, the aristocracy, and the day's most famed novelists and writers. In short, like Dickens, Thackeray, Disraeli. In short, Edmund Yates was a professional gossip. As Lauren McCoy argues in her essay, Waifs and Strays of Town Talk, the gossip column, quote, "In a competitive marketplace, gossip columnists jostled to prove their access to elite social circles, whether literary, artistic, or royal, in order to offer their readers the best details," end quote. Because the majority of readers had few, if any, opportunities to hobnob with prime ministers, lords, and famous authors, Yates could monetize his access to clubland. In short, Yates was trading on elite friendships that he had cultivated inside these spaces the way one might trade shares on the market. This pen and ink sketch of Thackeray began a fight Yates would go on to lose, and which would, as he later claimed, forever ruin his life and his career. The column's title was Literary Talk, and he described Thackeray thus, quote, Thackeray is cold and uninviting. His style of conversation, either openly cynical or affectedly good-natured and benevolent. His bonhomie is forced, his wit biting, his pride easily touched. But his appearance is invariably that of the cool, suave, well-bred gentleman who, whatever may be rankling within, suffers no surface display of emotion at all. Essentially, Yeats was accusing Thackeray of affectation, inauthenticity, and perhaps the worst insult, of being a cynic. Yeats also lambasts Thackeray's writing, saying the only thing that Thackeray ever accomplished with his sketches in Punch, arguably England's most popular and successful satirical journal ever, was producing, quote, mere scraps of writing and outrages on orthography, of which Thackeray is now deservedly ashamed, end quote. Immediately, a friend of Thackeray sent him a copy of Yeats' sketch. Thackeray, not unjustly, was incensed. He wrote to Yeats, demanding he desist. He accused him of libel and of purveying selling conversations he had no right to sell. Because Thackeray claimed only to have associated with Yeats at the luxurious and very exclusive gentleman's club, the Garrick Club, Thackeray writes, quote, I and other gentlemen at the Garrick Club have been in the habit of talking without any idea that our conversation would supply paragraphs or professional vendors of literary talk. And I don't remember that out of that club I have ever exchanged six words with you. Allow me to inform you that the talk which you have heard there is not intended for newspaper remark, and to beg, as I have a right to do, that you will refrain from printing comments upon my private conversations, and that you will henceforth please to consider any question of my personal truth and sincerity as quite out of the province of your criticism. Yeats escalated. He responded, quote, Sir, you will excuse my pointing out to you that it is absurd to suppose me bound to accept your angry understanding of my phrases. I do not accept it in the least. I altogether reject it. Thackeray retaliated. He took the matter directly to the Garrick Club's general committee, accused Yeats of selling private conversations collected at the club, and contended that Yeats' continued membership would, quote, be fatal to the comfort of the club and prove intolerable in a society of gentlemen. By bringing an element of vulgar journalistic commerce into this exclusive elite space, Yeats had turned private friendship into a commodity for public consumption. By the end of the summer, Thackeray had succeeded in getting Yeats kicked out of the club. Yet as early as July, all of literary London was gossiping about the Thackeray-Yeats row, aptly dubbed by Thackeray's own contemporaries as, quote, the Garrick Affair. From lowbrow Grub Street newspapers, anything coming out of Grub Street would be very lowbrow, uneducated. Nobody wants to be associated with Grub Street. Oh, and later in the Virginians, this is a side note, later in the Virginians, which Thackeray was penning at the time, created a character very much like Yeats and placed him in Grub Street. So this is a big insult here. So like the Reynolds newspaper, two prestigious literary journals, like the Saturday Review and the Spectator, everyone was opining about the Garrick Affair. Most rallied against Thackeray, condemning his behavior far more than Yeats. The Spectator blamed both Thackeray and the Garrick Club. Quote, the phrase, and here quoting Proverbs from the Bible, the Spectator blamed both Thackeray and the Garrick Club. Quote, the phrase, a soft answer turneth away wrath, is as true in any London club as in the world's greatest society. But it is remarkable that the want of absolute faith in such truths often characterizes the best educated. The author continues his preachy reprimand, quote, just because Mr. Yeats has managed his own case badly, it does not follow that his enemies, being Christians, should manage it for him as badly. Perhaps among the most scathing, however, was Stephen Fitzjames Stephen, a prolific writer for the Saturday Review, and who, like Thackeray, had been educated at Trinity College, Cambridge. Fun and interesting note about this era in Trinity College. So Trinity College thought that it... So this is just an important point, and it's really important to understand that Fitzjames Stephen's Fitz James Stephen went to Cambridge. The undergraduates at Trinity would wear blue academic robes instead of black academic robes. And this was so that they could communicate their higher status than anyone else at Cambridge. And so this is, so having that picture in your mind as I talk about what Fitz James Stephen says about Thackeray is going to be really interesting and important. Oh, and another fun note. While Thackeray was at Cambridge, he wrote for a small university publication called The Snob. So this is all connected. Okay, so Fitz James Stephen published an essay. Oh, sorry. Let me go back. Yes, so they've both been educated at Trinity. On 17th July, in the heat of it all, Fitz James Stephen published an essay titled Gentlemen Authors, in which he claimed, not without some schadenfreude, that there is indeed a kind of, quote, justice in Mr. Thackeray being the victim of Yeats' unsavory sketch. Stephen very publicly reproaches Thackeray for, quote, Barnumizing himself, turning the circus man, this American circus man named P.T. Barnum, turning his name into a verb. On the surface, the periodical press was condemning Thackeray's behavior, and one publication even chided Thackeray for not recognizing that a Goliath ought not to take such a hefty swipe at a little David, Yeats being early on in his literary career. This really killed Yeats's career in a lot of ways. So this fight about the Garrick affair was actually not about the Garrick affair. It was a proxy for something far greater. The Thackeray-Yeats feud took on momentous proportions in the periodical press because it was threatening a carefully crafted narrative about the ideal or the idea of the English gentleman. Most notably, too, how it intersects with who's in charge, who's producing the nation's literature. There was a lot at stake here that English literature ought not be supplanted by Grub Street professionals. Okay, so tied up in this discursive effort, this narrative effort, was not only narratives about imperialism, who should be running Britain's empire, but also who should be producing the nation's literature. As Fitz James Stephen argues in his Gentleman Authors piece, Grub Street journalists and literary hacks should not be supplanting England's great poets, like Tennyson, which at the end of Gentleman Authors, Fitz James Stephen basically says Thackeray doesn't hold a candle to Tennyson. In this piece, he implies that Thackeray is behaving no better than what might be expected from Grub Street writers. This is not to say that people like Fitz James Stephen were not enjoying watching Thackeray being lampooned in the press. They were. But nor could they stand quietly by while England's leading novelist made a public fool of himself for his ungentlemanly behavior. The schadenfreude stemmed from the reality that Thackeray had ridiculed and mocked many of England's elites in his own writing. And now it was very apparent that his skin was perhaps too thin to take Yeats' unsavory sketch with grace. Okay, at the same time, however, who was and who was not a gentleman had been, in fact, a much longer literary fight. It constituted, by the 1840s, something akin to a national discourse. I think you could say it was definitely a national discourse. One year before Thackeray's first installment of The Snobs of England in Punch, The Spectator had published a piece called The English Gentleman. According to The Spectator, the ever decorous and self-reliant English gentleman possesses unquestioned honor, is brave, and he has a, quote, taste for literature and science. Moreover, he is humane, voracious, and abhors ostentation, though his plainness is free from rusticity. It is into this literary context that I read Thackeray's The Snobs of England series, in which Thackeray's satire undermines this national discourse on the English gentleman. His satire, or what Yeats may have called Thackeray's cynicism, implicitly argues that England's elite are not fit to rule the British Empire. They are corrupt, self-serving, certainly ostentatious, and morally blind. In the second installment of The Snobs of England, aptly titled The Snob Socially Considered, Thackeray ridicules the discursive attempt made in the periodical press and in, and very importantly, and in other forms of writing, like Disraeli's The Coningsby, this really focuses on another exclusive gentleman space, another exclusive male space, the public school, which in England means the private schools. and there's descriptions, there's very clear generic and character, not just borrowings, but a symbiotic relationship here between the snobs and Coningsby. And Coningsby was published in 1844, so just a few years earlier. So it's very fresh. Okay, lost my place. Okay, Thackeray ridicules the discursive attempt, the narrative attempt, made in the periodical press and other forms of writing, like Disraeli's Coningsby, to justify England's empire and aristocracy by means of the mythos of the English gentleman. So this is where the Reform Bill becomes very, very important, because this is seen as under threat. And so there's got to be a way for the aristocracy to justify their privilege and their, you know, their continued existence, their continued relevance, when they're no longer the only, they are dominating, but after having opened up some degree of access to the polis. This is partly why Thackeray savagely attacks Britain's practice of rule by friendship or aristocratic rule in the snobs of England. Okay, let's talk about the snob socially considered now. So the snob socially considered begins as a mock heroic tale. The narrator, a self-proclaimed snob himself, The narrator, a self-proclaimed snob himself, compares his work with a capital W with the great military men of history, like Mr. Washington in the American colonies, or Robespierre, and even Alfred the Great. His work, again with a capital W, he claims is, quote, to discover and to remedy a great social evil in England. This conviction, he says, has pursued me for years. He has been, in fact, quote, prepared for and now led by an irresistible necessity to enter upon his great labor, end quote. Then he takes on a biblical tone, again implicitly positioning himself as a world historical figure. He writes, quote, first the world was made, then, as a matter of course, snobs. They existed for years and years and were no more known than Americans, but presently the people became darkly aware that there was such a race. That name had spread over England like railroads. Another snobby slight. Subsequently, snobs are known and recognized throughout an empire on which I am given to understand the sun never sets. Punch appears at the ripe season to chronicle their history, and the individual comes forth to write that history in Punch, end quote. The mock heroic opening is, of course, borrowing from 18th century literature and the picaresque. Punch's educated readership would thus know the character being placed before them, before the tale even really begins. This Punch piece, through its generic signaling, the genre of key signals would be the inn, so this is going to take place inside an inn. So this Punch piece, through its generic signaling, its form or genre, informs the reader that this narrator, this snob, this self-proclaimed snob, will be a self-inflated rogue with few moral scruples. He will make friends effortlessly and betray them even more easily. Moreover, the mock heroic form is also taking a satirical swipe at the self-referential and morally blind aspects of British imperial rule. Readers well-versed in the 18th century novel, and many among Punch's readership would have been, would already know the narrator who is about to entertain them. He will be a swindler and a petty man, not the world historical, gentlemanly, military-like leader he thinks of himself to be. The snobs piece begins, so that now we're on the second installment of the snobs socially considered. So the second installment begins with the friendship between Mr. Marrowfat and the narrator. Mr. Marrowfat had, initially, greatly pleased the narrator and had even garnered his esteem. But something happened that required the narrator to, quote, forgo my intimacy with him. While dining one day at the Europa Coffee House, an inn, which the author carefully points out is, quote, opposite the Grand Opera, and as everybody knows, is the only decent place for dining at Naples. Mr. Marrowfat is observed eating peas with the assistance of a knife. This is, of course, a severe violation of table manners, as one ought to pierce one pea at a time with one's fork, eating the peas one by one and very, very slowly. Marrowfat, by using his knife, was essentially shoveling peas into his mouth. Thus, by association, Marrowfat's dining faux pas would look badly on the narrator's social status. Immediately, the latter decides to cut his acquaintance to preserve his social status, despite the fact that Marrowfat had, earlier in their friendship, saved his life and even loaned him £7,000. In an unheroic, cowardly way, the narrator employs another friend to deliver the news to Marrowfat, the news of their dissolved friendship. The second friend's name is the Honorable Polyanthus. Two words, poly and then separate anthus. This will become relevant in a moment. By 1841, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the flower's name, Polyanthus, one word, was cited as a species of the genus Narcissus. The joke is, of course, just thinly veiled enough to absolutely delight Thackeray's targeted audience. As for the narrator, he anticipates the reader's judgment, defending his decision thus, quote, even though everybody at Naples had remarked upon the separation of Damon and Pythias, what was I to do as an English gentleman, end quote. Okay, a quick note about Damon and Pythias, or Damon and Pythias. This was a legendary friendship. Anyone who was versed in the classics, and many of Thackeray's readership would have known this friendship. It is also a political reference. So they undermine the ruling, the dictator in the Greek city-state in which this friendship takes place. So there's layers. Not only is it a famous friendship and one of loyalty and great esteem, but it literally undermines the dictator. So that's just an important side note. Okay, so over time, back to the snobs. Over time, the two men continue to... Okay, so now we're back to Marrowfat and the narrator. So over time, these two men, despite the dissolved friendship, continue to meet, quote, in the halls of the aristocracy and even jostle each other at dances. However, quote, the estrangement continued and seemed irrevocable. Until one evening, when at a dinner party, the author sees, actually they're coincidentally, they just happen to be seated together. When you're reading the original text, there is tension here. Both the narrator and the reader is nervous about what is going to happen. So the author is sitting next to Marrowfat. He sees Marrowfat eating peas with, quote, his fork, like any other Christian. Suddenly, old times rush back upon me, and I fondly remembered, quote, old services rendered, and Marrowfat rescuing me from the brigands. The narrator gleefully tells his reader from then on that the two, quote, have been the closest friends ever since. Though the author carefully notes that Marrowfat never repeated, this is a quote, never repeated his odious pea-eating habit again. I inserted the pea-eating. As the host of characters fills out and the friendship drama ensues, Punch's readership is invited to laugh at the toxicity of how male friendship is practiced among England's ruling elite. In Punch, these men are portrayed as a group of narcissistic men playing silly social games, hence the polyanthus signals. They're ridiculous, which, by the way, because English gardens are so prominent, so important, anyone, you know, on their estate or even with a modest garden would be very aware of the names of these flowers. So in Punch, these men are portrayed as a group of narcissistic men playing silly social games, not ruling the empire. Their ridiculousness is emphasized by the incongruity, the mismatch between their military titles and their frivolity. Thackeray's satire coyly suggests that the men running the empire are fickle, fair weather, and silly. Most certainly, they are not a moral elite. which this national discourse on the English gentleman is very much trying to establish. If they lose some of their stronghold on politics, like after the Reform Bill, then they have to be elite for another reason. They need to be in charge for another reason. And their moral leadership was often cited. And so Thackeray is undermining this very intentionally. So in the broader literary landscape and the national discourse, Punch challenged portraits of elite male friendship, especially as it intersected with empire building and the idea of the English gentleman. Thackeray, broadening this out. So Thackeray is a complicated figure in the context of an evolving English discourse around gentlemanliness and the aristocracy. In many ways, from the pedigree of his birth and education to his own clubland habit, he was quite the clubbable man. He seemed to embody the very essence of the ideal English gentleman. In other ways, however, he felt and was, in fact, different from his elite peers. Having lost his inheritance due to a combination of gambling, poor business investment, and family misfortune, he had to work for his living. Both Gordon Rae and Robin Gilmore attribute some of Thackeray's complex class identity to having been born in India. Despite having moved to England as a young boy for his education, he could never forget the, quote, humiliation suffered by the returned Indians, and here he means the English who were maybe born or raised in India or lived there for a long time and then came back. So by the returned Indians, whom half a lifetime of arduous service to the empire had given them a detached and critical perspective from which to view the structure and customs of English society. As Robin Gilmore writes, Thackeray was, quote, often ambivalent about gentlemanliness. The snobs of England, and yeah, just to contextualize this, so the writers, right, so the writers of the periodical press like FitzJames Stephen really did see this as hypocrisy, but Gilmore is suggesting that it's indeed not hypocrisy. So the snobs of England certainly sought to expose the folly of gentlemanly behavior and their class prejudices by satirizing the absurdity of upper class rule by friendship. At a moment in English society when demands for greater political enfranchisement, again, that is the Reform Bill and democratizing the polis, were being made. Thackeray's satire is in the wake of the first Reform Bill, which granted a very... Oh, sorry, I've already talked about this. So as Gordon Rae argues, Thackeray won his high position among his contemporaries chiefly by redefining the gentlemanly ideal to fit a middle-class identity rather than an aristocratic context. So before closing, I want to return to the beginning of this talk, namely to Yeats' accusation of cynicism and hypocrisy and FitzJames Stephen's claim that Thackeray was essentially, justly, Yeats' victim. While Thackeray's satire in the Punch series parodies romanticized representations of elite male friendship in other texts, again, like Disraeli's Coningsby, it also levels a much broader social critique, one he made overtly in a travelogue called Little Travels and Roadside Sketches, published several years earlier in 1840. I guess not several, 5 or 6 years earlier in 1840. In describing his visit to the Waterloo battlefield just outside Brussels, Thackeray noted that the only names of the military elite were honored there or recognized there. He writes, and with very clear ire, that the bodies of the myriad privates who had fought and died at Waterloo had simply been, quote, shoveled into a hole, namelessly with all the other dead privates. There was no placard, no official recognition of them as individual men. The cynicism here is tough. Quote, the individual men were the ones who fought the battles, but it was the officer who was knighted because the men fought so well. But English glory is too genteel to meddle with those humble fellows, end quote. Then moving from cynicism to the didactic mode, Thackeray ends his travelogue, this is the last part of the travelogue, on a tone of direct moral critique. Quote, let an Englishman go and see that field, and he never forgets it. Never forgets it is in all caps. So this is pretty emphatic. The sight is an event in his life, and I will wager that there is not one of them but feels a glow as he looks at the place and remembers that he too is an Englishman. It is a wrong, egotistical, savage, unchristian feeling, and that's the truth of it. A man of peace has no right to be dazzled by that red-coated glory and to intoxicate his vanity with those remembrances of carnage and triumph. End quote. In the periodical press and newspapers, Thackeray was accused of cynicism. I also see cynicism in Thackeray's writing. However, unlike his adversaries in the periodical press, I see the cynicism as not only a productive literary mode, but also a technique that Thackeray used deftly, adroitly, in promotion of ethical discourse. In fact, arguably, had Thackeray been less capable in his application of cynicism across genres, he would not have received the same degree of verbal lashing out in the periodical press over the Garrick affair. Helen Small, who's my supervisor, shout out to Helen. Helen Small, this book just came out in 2020. Helen Small, in her book, The Function of Cynicism at the Present Time, writes that when one is accused of being a cynic, he or she is often being suspected of self-styling, and quote, and untroubled by the consequences that might flow from disdaining accepted norms of behavior in the public domain, end quote. Thackeray's adversaries seemed to imply that Thackeray's cynicism was too easy, too sloppy, not well thought out, hence the accusations of hypocrisy. Helen Small explains this application of the word cynicism as positioning it as a reactive and therefore not an intellectually or philosophically credible discourse or technique. But this view of cynicism, and here I'm agreeing with Helen Small, but this view of cynicism is itself uncritical, as Small argues in her book and as I am arguing now. Taking direction from Small, I argue that Thackeray's cynicism was neither reactive nor self-styling. Rather, his cynicism, whether taking form in Punch's satire, Vanity Fair's realism, or Roadside Sketch's didacticism, performed a vital role in the broader literary discourse about England's imperial policy and the aristocracy's monopoly, or near monopoly, over domestic rule. Small's interest in cynicism, as is mine, is about, quote, how and to what ends writers have engaged with cynic modes or models in order to recalibrate certain dominant values, judgments of taste, and political agreements, end quote. By mocking toxic forms of elite male friendship in the snobs of England, Thackeray is implicitly pushing for greater democratic and liberal progress. Cynicism, when skillfully employed, as it was in Thackeray's case, comprises, and here again I'm quoting Helen, comprises, quote, a set of linguistic practices aimed at calibrating a plausible, sufficiently robust articulation of ideals, end quote. So I want to end by suggesting that Thackeray, in his cynic mode, is actually an idealist. In the Snobs of England series, he arrives at his ideal of friendship in a via negativa way. Via negativa is what the medieval philosophers and theologians, instead of trying to prove that God exists directly, they would prove it in a negative way. So that's what I mean by via negativa. So he arrives at his ideal of friendship in a via negativa way. That is, he demarcates ethical forms of friendship by outlining their negations, by employing cynicism, humor, and satire throughout the Snob series. Thackeray implicitly asks the reader to take up the burden of ethical discourse for him or herself. He places the reader in such a position that he or she must now ask the important questions about real friendship and about England's empire. What is friendship exactly? What is it not? Is it about dinner parties, raising one's social status, or maintaining one's position? Is being an English gentleman or gentlewoman about table manners, leisure, and enviable associations? But of course, then the next question, which is much more political in nature, arises. Are these the people who should be ruling over England's empire? These questions, I would argue, are just as pertinent today as they were in Thackeray's context. So, thank you. That is that is all.
Thank you so much, Camille, for this really fascinating talk, which really encompasses a number of themes, both on, you know, Victorian society, the early Victorian society, from the point of view of politics, from the point of view of manners, from the point of view of peace, which is particularly important, and of course also seen through Thackeray's literary scope. So I'm sure you will have questions from the audience, either the in-person audience or our audience online. If you do have questions or remarks, and of course I can start with a question for you. I'm just making sure that there are no questions from our colleagues online. Okay. Right. Shall I start?
Yes.
Well, I was fascinated particularly by this question of, you know, the way in which Thackeray approaches the discourse on the gentleman at this particular period. So you mentioned the first Reform Act, which was passed in 1832. I think it was published in 1846 in Punch. So, what could be the possible interpretation of this particular period? Of course, Punch was created in 1841. But this was, was there anything particular which could explain the fact that this particular discourse, this particular exchange took place in the mid-40s?
Ah, okay. That's an excellent question. I'm not sure I can completely answer it, but I will try.
You're talking about the gentleman discourse?
Yeah.
So John Henry Newman, he publishes his, but it's in 1854, I believe, 1854. And it's within the university, it's in his university piece. So the reason why I go there, John Henry Newman is often, and please argue with me if you think so, but often when the gentleman discourse comes up, usually he's pointed to, like he's a grandfather in the discourse. And so what I found particularly interesting when I got into this is that it has a longer history. And so the English gentleman published the Punch series begins in February, I believe, of 1846, and the Saturday Review's English gentleman was 11 months earlier. So I don't know, I can't answer specifically to say, oh, this happened in 1846 or something, and so this is why it comes to the fore. But I can say the 40s and the 50s was when this discourse was happening. And we see, even when Disraeli writes, when he pens his Coningsby, we can just see a lot of authors are vying for this. But I'm wondering if actually you might have something in mind.
No, okay. Thank you so much. No, I was just thinking that it's particularly interesting that at the same moment when the aristocracy are kind of losing their grasp on the country, because, of course, as you said, you know, the suffrage has been extended to, well, actually a tiny portion of the upper middle class, but it has been slightly, you know, extended to another section of the population. I think that it's particularly interesting that this is called this sort of dialogue on what is a gentleman, what is, you know, also a gentlewoman, but here it's the gentleman. I think that it's particularly interesting that it takes place, in these particular years, and this insistence and manners and all the satire. So,
actually, can I just piggyback on that again?
Yeah,
because absolutely, this is just an interesting threat, isn't it? Because, like you said, the enfranchisement was small, but the threat was huge. It's an interesting dichotomy or exchange, but also
The 1830s and 1840s, you have, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but you also have in the mix, and I think this helps explain why the aristocracy is so threatened. Like, it's not just the Reform Bill, but it's like, what even made the Reform Bill possible? So you have, in the 1830s and 1840s, you've got two cultural things happening. You have the welfare reform movement happening, and you also have the factory reform movement happening. The condition of England question. So these two things are just broad cultural phenomenon in terms of you speaking in those terms. Wealth is being acquired outside the aristocracy. So wealth is being acquired by, business.
Yeah.
Not from land, not from birth, but from getting one's hands dirty. And even some of these discourses, like in Vanity Fair, when you look at a character named Dobbins, his father is a merchant, but he's going to an elite public school. And then even George Osborne, his father is a merchant, but at least he has a carriage. So he's the son of a wealthier merchant. So all of this is, there's this interaction between how is the aristocracy going to maintain its power when people outside the aristocracy are gaining wealth and demanding representation, demanding to be involved in politics. And then I'll say one final thing, and then I'll just pass the baton. But also, literature is important here, and I didn't have a ton of time to go into it, but literature is being written by professional news people, like people in the news. These are not Byrons. These are not, and to go way back, we're not talking Milton. We're talking journalists producing the national literature and gaining great prestige among readers. But there's still that fight. Those who consider themselves gentlemen, they're producing a different kind of literature than this common literature. So I think it's all.
Yeah, it's not so far away from grassroots.
It's not. It's too close.
Yeah, it's very close.
And grassroots. Yes, and in other places where Thackeray's writing, he tells a secret. So in History of Pendennis, he actually talks about the people who are Lord so and so writing this opinion column. They did it at the public house with a pint of ale. This is that everybody is being hoodwinked.
So. Thank you so much. Do we have any more questions from the audience here or online? I'm just going to check.
What about the word snob itself? Isn't it coined by Thackeray, was it? It was already used before him. Who was the first one to invent the word?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to repeat the question just in case the mic didn't pick that up. So the question was about the word snob itself. Who coined the term? What was Thackeray's role with regard to the word? So I'm going to take a little bit of time to answer, so I'm going to go through quite a bit. So as I mentioned, I think first of all, at the outset, it's important to know when Thackeray wrote this series, he was redefining the word. So the word did have an economy outside of the snobs of England, but he fundamentally changed it to the way that we think of it now. The snob in Thackeray's Snobs of England, right, they're an aspirant, they're ervants, they're affected. When Thackeray was in Cambridge, one would call somebody a snob who is out, didn't have access to elite institutions. And you would tell a snob by his shoes or, and actually Gordon Ray talks about, it's a specific kind of shoe. It wasn't the lowest low class shoe, nor was it the high boots of the aristocracy, but it was like this mid-height boot. Those were the snobs, and it was derogatory, and it denoted, someone from the lower classes, not a snoot, which is more of the way that
Thackeray uses it. Do you want to add anything to that? It's fantastic. And Thackeray also coins another phrase. This is just another fun tangent. Just to show how inventive he was with language. He coined the phrase. So yes, if you look in Oxford English Dictionary with snob, it has a usage prior to Thackeray. After Thackeray, it fundamentally changes, and we use it that way now. The word Oxbridge, which is Oxford, Cambridge mushed together, nobody used it before Thackeray. Thackeray invents that word, and then there's a conversation in the periodical press about whether this is ridiculous, whether it's stupid, whether it has a point. So he you know, and it's and a character, Pendennis, goes to Oxbridge. So he's able to satirize or parody the Oxford Cambridge snobs in the later meaning through Oxbridge, the term. And if you it's really fun. If you go to the OED, Thackeray, he's the first. It's particularly fun.
Are there any questions?
Oh, can I say, sorry, one more thing.
Of course,
I think
absolutely.
Implicit in what I was saying, but I didn't make it explicit, was by applying this low class word or a word in common parlance meant to denote a lower class to these erivants, to these people vying for social position. I mean, to his contemporary audience, it would have been really affronting to call them snobs. So, whereas today, you know, if somebody calls you a snob, there's this implicit like, well, you know, I've got some class, I'm just trying to rise above my level. This is a very ingenious play on the word.
Yeah. Questions?
No, can I just make a little, a small parenthesis in French, actually?
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with this song by Boris Vian called Je suis snob.
No.
It's hilarious. No. And, you know, it's the same definition. Like, for instance, he says he doesn't have... he doesn't have just a pain in his stomach. He has an ulcer because it's less banal and more expensive.
Okay.
You see, the whole song,
whole
song is like this.
Okay.
So, you know, he has a TV set, but he's turned it around in his drawing room because that's better. You know, so it's all, that's just a little parenthesis. And the other thing I was thinking was going back to the clubs. That's a topic in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember the first time I walked down Pall Mall,
okay.
The shock
okay.
of the very existence of these...
The chandeliers and the portraits and the windows start above your head.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. And I was thinking it's maybe something that fascinates... Again, it's a French reference. I'm thinking of... Jules Verne, you know, le tour du monde en 80 jours. You know, journey around the world in 80 days. You know, because it starts. That's where it starts, isn't it?
Okay.
It starts in a club in London.
Okay.
And if I remember well,
I think it was a dare from his fellows to see if he could really do the. Go around the world in about 80 days.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think there's something, I don't remember the details, but I think there's something about class there, even though we're all within they're all within the same club. There is, obviously that's an outsider's point of view, but
it
might be fun to look at it.
It is written down. Thank you. That is great.
Silly question about peas, but...
no, peas are important.
Yes.
Did you actually... highlight somewhere in there the origin of so-called marrow fat peas?
No, I did not.
Okay.
Yes, and it has been, it's actually been a few years since I've looked in, since I came across it accidentally because somebody else brought it up. Yes, somebody else brought it up in another talk. So is it fresh on your mind? Or like, do you have a fresh access to it?
No, I'm sorry. I'm not even a man of literature. I'm a man of the visual arts.
Okay.
I do have I do have a recollection of living in the UK for a number of years, and having noticed in Tesco cans, tins of marrow fat peas.
Yes.
What sort of peas are these? I should probably just Google it. but listening to what you were saying and learning new things afresh, practically, because I'm not so familiar to the world of Thackeray apart from film adaptations.
Okay.
I heard about Horrified Peace. I thought I made a link there in my mind.
Yes.
With the novelty you were discussing and the etiquette.
Yes.
Around peace.
Yes. Thank you. You are the second person to bring that up, and so I must listen.
Right.
It must. Yeah. I love the names, mm-hmm. and I have very much learned to slow down. Like even Polyanthus, slow down. What are these names? And in the first installment of The Snobs, I mean, this is much more on your, like, on the sleeve, but Colonel Snobley. Colonel Snobley is. But I also love in Vanity, in Pendennis, the doctor who goes, the snobby uncle who's also vying to get into a higher social status and all that, he sends Dr. Goodenough to go. He goes off on a shooting party with Lord Stein and sends Dr. Goodenough to go take care of Pendennis. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah, I think that's a question.
Oh, thank you so much for your talk, and especially for your closing, or your conclusion mm-hmm. at the end, about who has power in society mm-hmm. and what Francis Hegel does. I found this very interesting, like, as a modern point of view. And you said at the beginning that you're talking about quite a bigger project, so
yeah.
You're not only talking a small one. Would you like to comment a bit on your idea? And also, I was quite interested in your corpus. So what exactly were you based on today, and what would you like to investigate, analyze in the future?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, fascinating. So this is a very beginning project, and it's one of those things that I wanted to do more work on in my thesis, but because of word limitations and focus, I had to slice it off and say, okay, so this will be this. So I'm going to tell you that. So the origins is that my thesis looked much more so at what I would say like positive friendships, so the ethics of friendships in terms of like being there in times of need, loyalty, fidelity, and I became, in the process of doing my thesis, very drawn to horrible friendships. But there was no room in the thesis to really go into it. And so, this was, actually, and we chatted a little bit earlier, Thackeray's Barry Lyndon, but that is a picaresque novel, and so just looking at how toxic friendships play out. So, that was the origin of it. And so very interested in Thackeray. I probably will not go into Barry Lyndon, but I will definitely be doing... So I did a small thing on Snobs here. But in when Snobs goes from its serialized form into a publication, it actually ends on friendship. In the last paragraph, makes a comment on friendship. And so I will be working with... This is about friendship. I mean, of course, it's about a lot of things and a lot of snobs and a lot of stuff. But the book ending in friendship is very clear structurally. And then because it's new, everything else that I'm about to say, they're sketches, they're ideas. But I'm very interested in toxic friendship in Bleak House, in Dickens' Bleak House. And the connection with Leigh Hunt. I don't know if anybody has studied, read about the real life friendship between Dickens and Leigh Hunt. So Leigh Hunt becomes a character and he's horrible. And it's really fun and delightful to see how Dickens gets back at Leigh Hunt with that character. He is also a member of the elite, and he is malazy, he doesn't work, he bums money from people, he's a leech. And so you can see, like, okay, there's also a political statement being made here. And there's another friendship in Hard Times, in Dickens' Hard Times, that I'm interested in. And then that's the most formed that I have, but there's also some really good, bad club friends in Trollope. So Trollope's Palliser series has a whole host of friends that are wretched, that I could not devote time to. That's all I have right now.
but I would like to fill it out with female friendships. Although there's a lot of energy there, right? Because of gender stereotypes. So, yeah, I wish I could give you more. But if you have ideas, I would take them. Or, I mean, I would. I think that would be interesting.
I have an idea for the contemporary, for the contemporary stuff. I think you should read The Fraud by Zadie Smith, because as I was saying earlier on, it centers around Ainsworth as a novelist now forgotten. But because he's a novelist, he has dinner parties and he has Thackeray coming over and he has Dickens, and there are many comments about the relationship, the relationships. You know, the lows and highs of the relationship between all of them, and the illustrators from Punch mentioned too. You'll enjoy that.
Okay, thank you.
And it might prove useful as well.
It will get me into contemporary. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Some artists were considered as snobs or dandies. Thinking about Proust, for example, or Brunel.
Okay.
Is there a connection between dandyism and snobbery?
That's interesting. I'm thinking, this is off the cuff. Linguistically, I feel that maybe not, but I'd have to do some looking into it. But at least the surface level of it, yeah. Mm. So Brummel is interesting. So, yeah, Brummel's really interesting. Does everybody know what a dandy is? I don't know if... Okay, all right. So Brummel, when he would...
I studied the picture of Dorian Gray.
Ah, okay. Okay, fabulous. We've got the same... All right. Well, Brummel was known for snubbing, like, the Prince of Wales. And he got away with it. Yes... So the affectation, the surface level, the concern with the surface level instead of the interior, how do you gain status? It would be, very affected. But I've never, and it's interesting, right, because when I talked about the snob and with regard to his shoes, like one of the things that would be pointed out would be, like in the earlier usage of the word snob, so that would be actually really interesting. Do you have any ideas?
No.
Okay. I think that's worthwhile.
Maybe the fact that at the time in Punch there was a series about what they called the swells. The swells were snobs before Thackeray. And the swells were everywhere. Okay. And you've got all these, cartoons about, the way in which the swells go, they just walk on the strand and they just, sort of performance. Yeah. So it's all very much about the Punch attitude to all that, which is extremely funny.
Well, that's interesting too. What do you think of the swells as like a linguistic forerunner to snob?
Yeah, I think it's close. I wouldn't be qualified to analyze but I think it's quite close, the swells, the snobs. And it's really something which, goes on in Punch. I've worked quite a lot, on the end of the century. And you find it again and again, with other artists. And actually, the swells.
Okay.
The swells, particularly the snobs, was really Thackeray's,
Oh, that's fantastic.
But the swells, they appear, recurrently. And about the flowers,
yes.
You mentioned the polyanthus, but you've got, everything about Narcissus and related to, Oscar Wilde, the dandy, walking in the city, walking in London with flowers in his hands. So you've got all this coming back. So I think it's sort of recurrent thread. In Punch, but of course this was early Punch.
Sure, but
so
still,
that's,
oh, I
yeah,
love that.
It's something which.
So
sort
you're
of,
talking like up into like the 1890s.
Yeah, 1880s, 1890s. Yeah, particularly 80s, 70s, and 90s. Yes.
That's very rich. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for that.
Do we have any more questions? Maybe from the online audience.
So great.
No, I was just wondering if you wanted to comment on the picture that we used for the poster that you sent us.
And
that we will see.
Okay. So if I remember correctly, so you've the at the top of the poster is just the very pretentious. They're eating, right? The fork one is actually. I did want to set the scene for the pea eating because that was just too much. But the chasing with the fork, I believe, happens in installment number one, where the narrator chases Colonel Snobley with a fork, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay, I'm trying to.
I think
find it.
He's got. Thank you. Okay, this whoever designed this, by the way, is just wonderful. This is really great. I mean, clearly, when you see the gentleman's faces, you think we would think pretty quickly a snob. But I wanted to highlight the tableness, the table manners. This is so. And you know, I think it was more it was definitely intuitive, but as I'm, you know, off the cuff, just that this idea about table manners, they meet in Colonel Snobley, Marrowfat, and the narrator meet at this cafe. So there's this clear reference to the 18th century. But, and the fork, even though this is installment number one and I talked about installment number two, I just thought it, you know, prepare us for inappropriate table manners. Oh, okay. I don't actually know who illustrated it, though.
I think it must be Lynch.
Okay.
I just would like to be sure that our audience online can see that. So that's one of the illustrations.
So this is actually installment number one.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's this theme, right? The table manners. Just to chat about this for a little bit. Even today, how one eats is so important. This is actually really fun. So. Just at all the formal dinners at Oxford, it becomes very clear, very quickly, who has more cultural capital by how one eats, what utensil one uses. But Thackeray really plays on this like throughout his corpus. So in Pendennis, I love Pendennis. I love Warrington. I love Pendennis. So showing my cards there. But Pendennis is the son of an esquire, but he finds himself at Oxbridge. He discovers that he loves drinking port, but port is only an after-dinner drink, so you can't have port with dinner, but he loves drinking port with dinner. But he knows it's not what one does, and what's really fascinating is, so he refrains from drinking port at dinner, and then until he meets Warrington, they meet in the Inns of Court, so another exclusive male space, and they're having dinner. And Warrington is the son of a baron. A baron is the lowest order of the peerage, so he's technically in the peerage. And so this matters, right? Warrington sits down and drinks port at dinner, at the Inns of Court. And Pendennis is like, great. and it actually, I can't remember the verb that is used, downs port at dinner. And so what is really fascinating is it's often the aspirants who have to obey the table manners. And actually the higher ranking one is they can break them. They don't have their identity at stake, they've inherited it. So it's fascinating to see like who plays by the rules, who doesn't need to. This is just, I mean, I don't know if it made news here in France, but it certainly made news in the Anglo press that when Kate Middleton went to her first dinner at Buckingham, she asked for a serviette, and this was ridiculed because the true upper class just calls them napkins. It is the middle class Erevants that ask for a serviette. So, So that was a very rounded out way of saying how much table manners just can betray, even your best efforts to raise yourself socially.
Yeah, really shows the importance we were talking about, the extension of suffrage and the way in which British society was changing at the time. Yeah. And there's, as you said, there was a great worry about the way in which, people could evolve in the British society, could go up, could, evolve in society. So, focusing on this etiquette was also a way of preserving, whatever space you actually had, and it was particularly important.
To bring it, and also just to bring it back to literature, this is very much a side point, but I was talking with a student earlier this week. We were trying to figure out together what was so innovative about Defoe. So I'm totally going off track here, and we got to the end of the tutorial without really answering the question. But the idea of literature being at stake, I think this is just so important, right? Because who's the subject of literature? Is it if you take something like Milton, going much farther back, but if the new subject of literature is the everyman or the everywoman, members of, the lower classes. Thackeray turns this on the head, right? He's talking about the elite, but he's undermining the project of the elite. So this idea of who should be characters in our literature is, that was also at stake.
Well, particularly in the satirical publication, because I think that's one of the very interesting things is that, Punch started really initially in Grub Street. I mean, when it was launched in 1841, it was really like four people gathering, in a tavern and talking about what are we going to do. So I think that it's interesting. And, of course, that's the whole satirical approach to it. I think there's both, fascination for the aristocracy and also revulsion and a lot of wit, because it's really funny. I've read some of the installments, and it's really, there's also something about the university snobs. We don't look good. So it's really a way of, looking at things. I think there's both fascination, revulsion, a degree of envy, and a degree of, distance, and I don't know about Thackeray's social background.
Do you mean his social life, or do you mean his...
sort of background, sort of family...
Family, yes. Okay. He was born in India. His father was a civil servant. He was... this is what you mean by social background.
Yeah.
Okay. So then he was, as was so common by the time, I think he was four or six, I can't remember which, he might have been six, was sent to England to be educated. So you basically, there's a whole body of literature actually written on orphans of the colonies, and it's a really fascinating body of literature in itself. Mm-hmm. But so he would have been one of those, orphans where you go... you're sent back to England to be educated there, but he had his early formative years in India. I forget some of the specifics. He was educated at these public schools, which are private schools. Started at Trinity, did not finish, and he was still moneyed. He had an inheritance. He dropped out of Trinity, moved to France, and he was a sub-editor for the—I'm not going to pronounce it correctly—but the
Charlemagne.
Yeah, yeah. He lost all of his money. So his father died. He was a notorious gambler at Cambridge and continued that in France. So like he lived in Paris for a while, lost all of his own money. This is how it went. He got into great debt through gambling. And then when he did get his inheritance, he purchased, and this is when he was living abroad, he purchased and purchased a journal, and it failed. So he lost all of his money. And he was writing for money, and he was the hat. He had to do this. And then, I talked about it just so briefly, but his class status is so complicated because he was born with the expectations of the elite, and he couldn't see that through.
Okay, so I think it's very interesting. It's very, yeah. And also the very cosmopolitan approach, born in India, brought up, spent some time in France.
Yep.
So you've got this sort of, outside...
Outside
the English, the way in which, because it's all, there's like 50 installments in the series of the snobs,
mm-hmm.
and it's about, club snobs and university snobs and clerical snobs, and so it's a sort of, very satirical view of England.
Very, yeah. And I really agree with Robin Gilmore in the sense of, so she pinpoints it, his complex class identity to being born in India, it's hard to be he really had problems with that is actually why I brought in his travel log, because I think this really gets lost in Thackeray's class identity, is he had a problem with the empire. He saw, he grew up with how it was being run in India, and like he had a problem with it. And I think that just gets, gets missed. That, underneath the jokes is a very serious political and ethical agenda.
I think there is, yes.
But he was snobby.
Oh,
as well.
That's the whole point of satire. Both inside and outside.
I mean, what he did to Yeats was pretty, was really reinforcing the class lines. Mm. So.
He married an Irish girl and met quite a few Irish people too. Mm.
Okay.
And wrote about Irish rogue and the Irish snobs as well.
Did he engage much with the Irish question or the Ireland question?
Well, not really.
Okay.
Just the difficult relationships between the two countries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Adding to his financial, just since you brought up his wife, because she was institutionalized, he ended up, and because his father died and they lost their money, through writing, he had to pay for her institutional life,
okay.
and had to financially support his mother. And he had three daughters.
Mm-hmm.
So all these women.
All these women, yes, all these women. So so this idea that he had to work for a living was, it was a chip on the took a chink out of his armor, but he had all these women he had to support.
And I think that, you were pointing out the fact that, of course, the journalistic world was, specific at the time. So all of these, at Punch, all of these writers, I mean, of course, some of them are quite famous at the time, but many others were not.
Did Mayhew, was May, was...
Yeah,
okay.
He was one of the founder members.
Okay. I need to, far more about this than I do, so I need to just spend more time there, but I thought, Mayhew,
Mark Lemon, those people initially, but they really had to support themselves in a very volatile and difficult marketplace, because this was, you pointed out the illustrations, but of course at the time this was, the first, not the first years, but really the years in which the periodical press, the illustrated press, the pictorial press really started on a massive scale. So there was a lot of competition, a lot of competition. So they had to hold on with their forks.
I have a question. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know how a journal like Punch would have been affected or not affected by the Stamp Act before it was repealed?
Yeah. I'm not quite sure. I think it was a stamps production, but it wasn't that expensive because the Stamp Act was suppressed, well, progressively, 53, 55, and 61. It was, I mean, the Stamp Act concerned particularly newspapers.
Okay.
And Punch was not a newspaper. It was a satirical magazine. So, in fact, it approached, I think the Stamp Act was really particularly focused on really the news, publishing something about the news, containing the news. And actually, Punch was sort of going around because they had this parliamentary column. So they were talking about politics. They were mentioning all the ministers and Disraeli and later on Gladstone and all these people. They were all there. But they were approaching politics and, you know, and the news through, you know, different perspective, in order to avoid taxation. Okay. So I think that's the way in which they worked.
Oh, that's very rich. Thank you.
Around the Stamp Act.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't actually realize the Stamp Act was progressive.
It was, it was first of all created in the late 18th century. It was reduced in 1836. And progressively in 1836 it was reduced, first of all, and then it was progressively repealed in the 1850s. So there was a series of repeals, 1853, 55, and 61.
Thank you. Thank you. That's excellent.
Well, they know that.
Yes, the dates.
They remember that. Do we have any more questions online or in real life? Okay. Well, thank you so much, Camille, for this beautiful presentation and for your very complete answers. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for being here. And